the science simply does not support the ridiculous hysteria around climate at all. Not at all. I mean, there is really no basis for the climate alarm in science, and yet we're told the complete opposite, and we're told the opposite by the scientific establishment as well.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Martin Durkin, director of Climate the Movie.
Something this huge, you would have thought, would be subject to a certain amount of critical scrutiny by the press, in the media, and yet it's not.
Martin's documentary has been viewed by millions, despite big tech censorship and mainstream media silence.
So it's really easy to refute the case, and I think that's possibly why they're so absolutely paranoid about a film like this getting out.
He talks about a new form of snobbery that drives environmentalism.
There is a fear and dislike of the masses themselves. There's a desire to put them back in their box. And that's being beautifully reflected in the policies around climate. The workers have got to fly less, the workers have got to drive less, the workers have got to be driven out of their cars. They have to be punished at every turn.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with Martin Durkin, filmmaker and director of Climate the Movie. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Lee.
Can you give us a quick intro to your new film and why you decided to make it?
Yes, it's a climate sceptic film. In fact, it aims to go further than being simply a climate sceptic film. It aims to knock the climate alarm on the head as far as it possibly can. And to arm the people who are sort of intuitively sceptical but haven't sort of got the arguments to hand because they've been deprived of them by a rather sort of climate alarm orientated media. So that was the purpose of the film.
So you made the Great Global Warming Swindle 17 years ago, and now you've made this one. It feels like in between there was very little TV or cinema level productions that explore this issue of not following the climate narrative. And why is this such a taboo subject?
Well, I think that this is actually really the point of the film. Why is it that on a subject so important as this, that is influencing public policy on such a huge level, you know, we're changing the cars we drive, the whole of the energy infrastructure of the West is being altered, so on and so forth. I mean, I can, you know, the list of where you put your rubbish in the bins, where you're allowed to drive and not allowed to drive, so on and so forth. Something this huge, you would have thought, would be subject to a certain amount of critical scrutiny by the press, in the media, and yet it's not. There is, to an extraordinary degree, a uniformity in the coverage of this. In fact, a taboo against speaking out against it. You know, you're vilified if you say this is all nonsense. And that's really the subject of the film. Why has this taken place, especially given, as we point out in the film, the science simply does not support the ridiculous hysteria around climate at all. Not at all. I mean, there is really no basis for the climate alarm in science, and yet we're told the complete opposite, and we're told the opposite by the scientific establishment as well. So that's really what we explore in the film. Why is there this enormous consensus on this subject? What is behind it? And why are contrary voices excluded, banned, vilified? Why has there been, you know, since the global warming swindle in 2007 and this film, 17 years later, there's been no single documentary that's dared to question the climate alarm? And that in itself is something we should be deeply worried about.
So you got together a whole host of experts for this film. There's even a Nobel Prize winner there. They must have been putting their careers on the line to some degree to do this. Was it difficult to get them involved?
Well, there was, I remember a couple of the people I had involved, Willie Soon and Sally Baliunas, who Sally Baliunas is a professor of astrophysics. They were both astrophysicists at Harvard and Smithsonian back in 2007. I remember arriving on a plane in Boston to interview them then and being told on the morning of the interview by the press office at Harvard that the interview would not go forward. They'd effectively been told that if they went forward with the interview, they'd be fired, their funding would be, and all that sort of thing. So I was denied being interviewed then. So it was quite nice, 17 years later, actually, being able to do it. You do risk your, as an academic, you don't even risk your career. Your career's ended pretty much in the sciences if you speak out against climate change and do so consistently. So you tend not to get younger people in academia piping up about it. We had one guy, Matthew Wielecki, who did a geologist, and you know, effectively he was shunted out. You know, he had to resign his post because you don't get funding. Your colleagues are really horrible to you because you're perceived to be right wing, so on and so forth. And you won't get published. No academic journal will publish you if you're saying stuff against the climate alarm. So we tend to, we ended up interviewing older people because older people who are really established, you know, once you've got your Nobel Prize in your back pocket, you can sort of say what you like because, you know, there's not much they can do about it. And Will Happer, who is professor of physics at Columbia and Princeton and is now emeritus professor, you know, he can say what he likes. But he's a really powerful interviewee and really lovely man as well. He himself said, you know, he kept his mouth shut, you know, earlier on in his career, despite his standing academically, because, you know, to do otherwise would be to, you know, really damage your career. And the same goes, I think, in a lot of, in the media too. You know, I suffered the consequences of making the Great Global Warming Swindle. You know, you're sticking your neck out. Luckily, we have Epoch Times, who are prepared to be far more open-minded than most sections of the media.
Thank you. If we look at the COP28, 85,000 people went to that. I think a lot of them flew there. But we can see the scale of this industry. And this is a $1 trillion industry. And you're getting together a host of distinguished experts. You're making a cinema-level film. You're putting it out for free, saying that this industry is basically based on lies. I mean, to a lot of very rich and powerful people, you're quite a dangerous guy. I mean, were there security issues you had to take into account in making the film?
Well, we were nervous making it, and my wife begged me not to make it because she, you know, we've had experiences before of sort of rattling the cage of the great and good in this respect. But not serious security industries. We wondered whether a cinema would host us or whether we'd be rejected. We knew that we'd have trouble putting the film out. We knew that no broadcaster would touch it with a barge pole. We knew that we'd have trouble getting coverage for it in the press, maybe negative coverage, but by and large they try and shut us out. And we thought we'd probably struggle with social media too. But actually we have been, I think, shadow banned by Facebook, shadow banned by YouTube. Facebook, are taking down posts and putting warnings against us. Instagram are doing something like that. Luckily, God bless Elon Musk, on X or Twitter, you know, we're going great guns. And I think the nature of kind of digital communication is now, because we've released it and allowed people to download the film and spread it, you know, to their heart's content, it's kind of growing like a virus. Yeah. And millions of people, I mean, we've now lost, you know, because we're not in control of the film, we don't know how many people have seen it yet, but it seems to be, you know, quite a lot of millions have now seen it.
It felt almost like a citizens' movement. YouTube were taking copies down and people were just putting them back up.
No, it was sort of they were doing their best to censor, but people were, and I think there's a kind of release of tension, you know, because there hasn't been a film since 2007, my last one. You know, people are sort of seeing this and think, thank God someone is making these arguments. Thank God someone is highlighting this science. Thank God someone is putting the counter case. So there's that release of tension you can feel in all these tweets saying, you know, you must watch this film, pass it on, you know, tell your friends to watch it and pass it on. You know, there's a kind of delightful fever behind it.
So the public reaction has been good. There's been very little in the mainstream media. I saw you were on Telegraph, but not much more.
Yeah, no, I think that they're trying to, I don't know why. I think they're trying to ignore us, trying to, you know, hoping it will go away. But it's very hard to criticise the film. You know, we've kept it very, very mainstream science. We've kept it to very obvious sort of science, which isn't really refutable. We haven't, you know, the odd thing is you can counter the nonsense about climate. To do that, you don't have to go to, you know, some crazy study carried out by some wacko guy over there. You can go through absolutely mainstream science and you can say, look, it's clearly not true. Even the IPCC accepts it. There hasn't been an increase in hurricanes. There hasn't been an increase in wildfires. We're in an ice age. You know, compared to the last 550 million years, this is an incredibly cold period. Compared to the last 550 million years, we have incredibly low levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. Despite all the stuff going in from industry, it's still incredibly low by geological standards. There is no time in the past that you can see CO2 driving climate. It's one of many greenhouse gases, and greenhouse gases as a whole form only a very small part of Earth's complex climate system. The idea that this gas is driving the climate, total nonsense, absolute nonsense. And you can show that with mainstream studies, multiple mainstream studies. It's really easy to refute the case. And I think that's possibly why they're so absolutely paranoid about a film like this getting out. A lot of the mainstream media, of course, have bought into it, either because, you know, they're sympathetic with the political cause of climate, it's kind of a left-wing cause, or because they're intimidated. You know, a lot of people have been intimidated from criticising it. A lot of people who you would expect to criticise it, you know, are sort of shy to. And in fact, a lot of people who are sceptics when you talk to them privately will be lukewarm as in public. They'll say, oh, well, maybe this is a problem, but maybe we could deal with it in a different way. You know, it takes a bit of bottle to go out there and say, this is all nonsense.
We saw there's a former World Bank economist saying that net zero is going to take us back to a wartime economy where ordinary folk can't afford luxuries anymore. It seems that the people that write these policies have little regard for the kind of ordinary folk and their lives. And we're seeing economic degrowth, which will destroy economies, you know, landscapes destroyed with all these windmills, communities destroyed with low traffic neighbourhood measures, works of art destroyed, all in the name of environmentalism. In who are these people? It's like a new class of people has developed. Who are they?
Well, a whole load of issues you've raised there, all of them really interesting. In terms of who they are, I think that part of the whole environmental movement as a large, but certainly the climate thing, is an expression of anti-capitalism. You know, the basis of environmentalism and this argument is that free market capitalism is wicked, and that what it needs is state intervention in order to contain it and regulate it and so on. And the people who are really, and that's a kind of particular form of anti-capitalism. It's not an anti-capitalism that says, oh, we've got to look after the workers, poor old workers, we need the workers to be richer. Mm. It's a kind of anti-capitalism that says the state must be more powerful. And those are quite different things. The people who want the state more powerful tend to be people who benefit from a more powerful state. You know, with the expansion of state, the state in the 20th century, and that's been extraordinary, by the way. I don't think people appreciate the degree to which the state has expanded since the First World War. I mean, in America, in the 19th century, in the 1870s, I think there were the US government employed 14,000 people. They could have fit into Arsenal Football Stadium four times with some seats remaining, even at the beginning of the 19th century. Many US companies employed more people than the US government did. I mean, you know, the US government was tiny. And the tax take was tiny. It was 6%, 7% for much of the, or less for much of the 19th century. In Gladstonian Britain, it was 4%. You know, the state was tiny in Britain too. And then the First World War comes and there's an enormous expansion of government in the West. I mean, gigantic. There was, you know, within the space of 4 years, there's ministry upon ministry upon ministry is being opened up in Britain. You know, the BBC's founder, the BOAC are founder. You know, generally, there's an enormous expansion of government. And this continues throughout the 30s. The Second World War sees another huge expansion. And so you have a point now where in the US and UK both, more than twice as many people work in government as work in manufacturing. I mean, you know, you tell that to, you know, one, you know, an early American that would ever be the case, and they would, you know, think that it's like saying we're being invaded by Martians. You know, that is such a bizarre. And that's only people who work directly for government. There is this huge tale of others who indirectly rely on government money and grants and so on and so forth. And whose jobs depend. Are defined by government involvement, strategy review people, public policy people, quangos.
This is the blob.
The blob, right. The blob, this enormous blob. It's not a little thing, it's an enormous thing. And what it has created is a whole class of people who view the state in positive terms, whose livelihoods depend on taxation, so they see high taxes as good, and whose jobs depend on government involvement because they're in some way related to government activity. Mm-hmm. And so they see government regulation as good. And this includes a large part of the intelligentsia, because unless you're doing a vocational course, in which course the intellectuals don't really regard you as a proper intellectual. If you're doing, at university, you're doing hotel management studies or accountancy, you don't count as an intellectual. If you're doing classics or something useless, then you're in their club. But for those people who've rejected the market and their choice of university courses, the market has its revenge, because if you've got a degree in sociology, no one wants you. But you find your salvation in a state job or in the third sector or something like that, which is where you feel more comfortable anyway. So there is this huge class, including the intelligentsia, that is pro-state. But you need a reason for state involvement. There needs to be obesity epidemics. There needs to be inequality. And the golden one, there needs to be a climate crisis. I mean, this really, the whole point about the climate crisis is that our lives need to be directed and guided and contained and so on and so forth. So for those people who intuitively are fond of state control, they are drawn to the climate, completely. And you can see this, if you go to a nice drinks party in Hackney, where there are people who run galleries and, the arts and science establishment is terribly into all this, or, our junior lecturers and all that kind of thing. If you say anything about, if you come out as a climate skeptic, you'll be regarded as, you've said that you voted Brexit or you like Trump. But if you're out on a golf course in Essex and you say, "Oh, climate crisis, a load of bollocks," then they'll buy you a gin and tonic and slap you on the back. That is the division. And likewise, the second-hand car dealers do not like high taxes and they do not like lots of regulation, but the leftist intellectuals do. So that's the kind of division of belief in global warming.
Right.
So that's really the kind of the social force, if you like, behind it. Nothing to do with science. These people, they don't understand anything. If you ask them about the, climate change and the Phanerozoic period, they'll just, look at you like, they don't know anything about science, neither group, but they know politically, what side they're on. And that's really the what's going on with the climate alarm.
Just a characteristic with these people that they don't really care so much about rights being removed and the economy being damaged and things like that.
No, they couldn't give a flying bugger about that. They want the growth of the state. The odd thing is about people who love an extension of state power. There's this myth that businesses, they're short-sighted, whereas people who the government is long-sighted. This is absolute nonsense. I mean, there are people who rely on public spending, people whose livelihoods depend on government spending, they crave it with a kind of almost insatiable, ravenous appetite. And so they will shove up taxes until they can go no further, and then they will borrow money like there's no tomorrow. I mean, the government debt at the moment is gigantic, absolutely gigantic. They will dish out public sector pensions until the liabilities are at utterly ruinous levels. They will print money in a totally reckless way. They will spend, and the fact that it will ruin the economy, they don't care. They're like this sort of hungry beast, sort of feeding off the sugar tit of public spending, and they do not stop. So they, and if you say, "Oh, it's going to ruin the economy," they don't care. They don't care. They want the state big. They want it well funded. They want their job to be, they want more jobs like theirs. They want more power. Nothing will get in the way of that. There's another thing. You mentioned the working class. Another thing about the anti-capitalism of the Greens, the anti-capitalism of the environmentalist movement. If you read their stuff, and I read lots and loads of their stuff now, from the very beginnings. This is a movement that stretches to the 19th century, the romantic anti-capitalism of the sort of the posh anti-capitalism, if you will, of the aristos who disapproved of capitalism, not because it was doing the workers down, but because it was elevating the workers, it was making them richer and more free, and that was sort of the rather disconcerting thing about capitalism. And so you had this romantic attachment to the past, the Vokist movement in Germany, the origins of fascism. But the environmentalist movement that sprang from all that in the 20th century, if you read their stuff, their hatred of capitalism is not because it's not producing enough. is producing too much. They hate it because they hate mass production, because of the huge proliferation of affordable products. They hate mass consumption, which they regard as gaudy and disgusting and horrible. They have an aesthetic, visceral distaste for the success of capitalism, not the failure of capitalism. And so there is a huge anti-consumerist rant in all of their literature. The world is consuming too much. Gaia can't cope. You know, there's all this kind of... Not them. They're not consuming too much. No. They're never consuming. There are never too many grants for, too many subsidies for opera companies or whatever. There needs more money spending on lecturers and all of that sort of thing. It's the masses who are consuming too much. Walmart is disgusting, IKEA is disgusting, McDonald's, anything to do with the masses. Mass consumption is revolting, mass production. And behind all this, if you read a lot of the output of the kind of anti-capitalist intelligentsia in the 20th century, there's a great book on this, John Carey's Intellectuals and the Masses. There is a fear and dislike of the masses themselves. There's a desire to put them back in their box. And that's being beautifully reflected in the policies around climate, because climate is entirely a product of the environmental movement, this whole scare. The workers have got to fly less, the workers have got to drive less, the workers have got to be driven out of their cars, they have to be punished at every turn. And this is why a lot of working class people absolutely can't abide. That's why I found an awful lot of scepticism among working class people, and why the Greens have so little support among ordinary working class people. In fact, if you look statistically, it's close to zero, the support for Green parties among, if you look at support by social class, working class people, they can smell when they're being targeted and when they're being attacked. And a lot of the supposedly socialist movements, today really hold, the white van man in total scorn, people who wave St. George flags and so on. And so there is a real anti-working class sentiment behind a lot of the climate alarm.
Like a new snobbery.
Snobbery. Absolutely snob anti-capitalism. And you can see it in a dislike of Americanism throughout the 20th century. America was what Ortega called the brutal empire of the masses. All these modern forms of communication like film had to appeal to the masses. Mass circulation newspapers had to appeal to the masses. This was this disgusting success of the masses that was threatening to the old intellectual gentry. All of that's being echoed in the climate debate at the moment.
We saw Rishi Sunak, when he was Chancellor, saying he wanted to rewire the global financial system for net zero. More recently, Labour are talking about decarbonising the electric grid by 2030 as well. The politicians know that these policies will bring a lot of hardship onto the ordinary folk, but they still push ahead. Why do they like these kind of green policies so much?
I think the class that we were talking about, the new class that you mentioned earlier, is enormously powerful. It controls the universities, it controls the schools, it controls the civil service, it controls much of the media. It is the class from which a lot of politicians have emerged. It's the class which surrounds politicians every day. It's the class that become journalists. So politicians are kind of, in a sense, part of it. They're also surrounded by advisors who think in those terms, and they're attempting to please a media which is sort of dominated by those views. And so, on the one hand, you've got this bubble of green blob sentiment and ideology, and then you've got the masses below, and they regard this bubble as more important than the masses below. And so you get the peculiar situation. Well, it's not peculiar, it's sinister, really, that we have the kind of facade of democracy, but not the actual content of it. So you have a lot of anti-green sentiment among the people as a whole. If the Green Party stands, they're going to get Caroline Lucas in, one MP. And yet, the entire political establishment is green. So, there is a non-reflection of the views of the ordinary people, in government. If you ask ordinary people, should we have massive public debts, they'd say no. If you asked ordinary people, do you think it's wise just to print money in a rather incontinent way, they'd say no. You know, if they said, do you think it's wise to have twice as many people working for government as working in manufacturing, they'd say no. You know, none of this nonsense. If there was more genuine democratic control, we would not live in the kind of society that we live in. Mm. We have a ruling class that hides behind democracy, but actually it manages to rule over and above and despite the wishes of the mass of ordinary people. That's why Trump's being so successful, because you know, finally, when people are saying, you know, God, here's a bugger who hates, however you define that class, the blob, the swamp, whatever, here's a guy who's standing out against it. He's our guy. He might not be perfect, but he's our guy because they hate him, therefore he must be doing some good. That's the kind of release that comes, and that's the release that came with the Brexit vote as well.
Do they really believe in these climate policies, 2030, for decarbonising the grid? Or do they know that it's not achievable, but it's just a political move?
I think it's the political momentum, because you have all these great stories of, you know, I don't know whether Al Gore is included among these, but these people who pontificate about, but they still buy, you know, seafront houses and they still fly around like anything. I don't think they really believe it. I mean, you know, if you really did believe that the world was going to end in two years, you'd be absolutely beside yourself. You'd be walking up Oxford Street shouting, you know, but they don't. They're making long-term plans. So I think there's an air of here's an alarm which we're going to sell to the masses, but we'll buy into, but not really take seriously.
Do you expect to see a rise of kind of anti-establishment movements? Maybe a political party that's against the green policies.
Well, we're starting to see it. I mean, there's Trump in the States. There's parties, you know, EFD in Germany. There's the farmers' movements in the Netherlands and Germany and elsewhere. You've got the collapse of the Tory party here. The Tory party is a green socialist party, effectively. The idea that it's a free market, you know, capitalist party is ridiculous. It's sort of got this Thatcherite wing, but that's it. That's deservedly going to collapse. Unfortunately, the Labour Party then will go, and that's another green socialist party, as it were. But you have the rise of reform. You're seeing that more in other countries. So there are certainly signs of resistance. The strength of the class that we're talking about is enormous. Their grip on, you know, school education, university education, the media, and civil service and the science and arts establishments is so powerful that it's very, very hard to break through. And there are very few voices standing out against it. I mean, again, Epoch Times, I think, is really admirable organisation, and I think is becoming enormously successful in the US precisely because it's actually doing what journalism is supposed to do, which is subject people to critical scrutiny. When you look at environmental journalists, they do not subject any of this nonsense to critical scrutiny. Where is the environmentalist journalist who has said, we haven't seen an increase in hurricane activity? They will say every time there's a bloody storm, oh my God, global warming. They never say there is absolutely no evidence for this whatsoever. They never put those charlatan scientists on the spot. They never challenge politicians. They're not proper journalists. They're part of the machine. An environmentalist journalist, for The Guardian or wherever else, their job depends on the crisis. Yeah, if there is no climate crisis, then an editor is going to say, well, we don't need, you know, an environmentalist correspondent. People aren't that interested in squirrels and hedgerows, you know, so you don't need that. So they're fighting for their job in pumping up this alarm. And so sadly, there is, you know, an almost total lack of objective, critical journalistic analysis was sort of going on in this and in other issues, actually. But as I say, I think that is why Epoch is doing so well, because it's actually kind of remembering what journalism is meant to be.
The lockdowns and their kind of after effects damaged a lot of people's trust in authority. I mean, do you think the COVID and the lockdowns paved the way for people to, you know, appreciate a film like yours more?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I mean, COVID, people saw that supposed experts talked a lot of rubbish. You know, what they said wasn't true. And that has, I think, had a knock-on effect for the climate thing, because, you know, people are now thinking, do you know what? These people are talking rubbish too. And people aren't stupid. They can see that, you know, Al Gore and others have been going on for, I mean, really, it's been since the 1980s. In the best part of 40 years, they've been saying that the world's going to come to end in about 5 years. It just keeps being recycled again and again and again. And yet people know that, do you know what? I can't, you know, this, the weather was like this, and, you know, when I was young and when my parents were about in the 1930s, you know, there hasn't been any noticeable change. So they're not sick, and they can see that, you know, economists are talking about, and it's not just in terms of COVID, it's not just in terms of climate. I think economists too, you know, the economists lined up at Brexit said that the economy will collapse day two if you vote for Brexit. You know, there'll be a day, of course, didn't happen. And those same economists have been saying, oh, it's all right to borrow trillions of pounds, for the government to borrow trillions of pounds. It's all right to print money. It's all right to have taxes massively high. That's not going to damage it. You know, I think people at every turn are thinking, these people are just chiselers. You know, they have their own agenda, they have their own self-interests, which is usually tied to bigger government, and we don't believe them. So I think that the thanks to COVID partly, but I think in other regards as well, the credibility of these people is deservedly being shot through.
And so what's next for you after this? What's your next project?
Well, if they don't catch me and lock me up in jail, I'm busy writing a book on the new class, on the class that you mentioned and we've been talking about, to try to describe its historical origins and its current significance. Because I think the problem with when people talk about the blob or the swamp, the problem is that, first of all, these terms are very vague. Who do we mean by those? By that? And also, it kind of suggests that they're just another interest group, like big finance or the trade union movement or whoever else. And what I want to argue, what I argue in my book, is that actually it's much more of that. It's not just a little interest group. It's an entire social class, and it is the ruling class. And once you accept that, actually, it kind of overturns an awful lot of existing perceptions about the nature of the society we live in. The Marxists have been very successful in kind of defining how we think of the society we're in. They say we live in a capitalist society, and the ruling class, they say, is capitalistic. You know, despite the fact that it's a democracy, the ruling class is capitalistic. Well, this is completely nonsense. I mean, if capitalists were the ruling class, we'd have very low taxation and very little regulation. They clearly are not the ruling class. The ruling class is the new class that we talked about, and it is anti-capitalist. We have an anti-capitalist establishment. That's why you have King Charles and all the royals and all the old Etonians who are all so into Greenpeace and all that sort of thing. You know, the anti-capitalists are the establishment. That's the weird thing about the current sort of world in which we live. We have a ruling class that doesn't like capitalism, and it's not anti-capitalist because it loves the working class. On the contrary, it's anti-capitalist because it wants to contain the working class and it has its own set of interests. And so once you start to recognise that class, the swamp, the blob, as an entire social class, and furthermore as the ruling class, then the way you look at society, and also history rather, changes a lot. And in fact, going back in time, what my book does is look at the development of capitalism and say, actually, this was a genuine workers' revolution. This was a revolution from below capitalism. And the erstwhile ruling classes of the past are kind of still busy trying to contain it. The old ruling class has taken a new form, but nevertheless, it's the same game to feed off the rest of us and control the rest of us. That's the new ruling class, and that's what the book's about.
Martin Decker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Lee.